When Jesus came down the mountain, he stopped at a level stretch where there were many of his disciples. A large crowd of people was with them from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. Then, raising his eyes to his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you, poor, the reign of God is yours. Blessed are you who hunger, filled you shall be. Blessed are you who are weeping, you shall laugh. Blessed shall you be when men hate you, when they ostracize you and insult you and prescribe your name as evil because of the Son of Man. On the day they do so, rejoice and exult, for your reward shall be great in heaven." Thus it was that their fathers treated the prophets. "But woe to you, rich, for your consolation is now. Woe to you who are full, you shall go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, you shall weep in your grief. Woe to you when all speak well of you. Their fathers treated the false prophets in just this way."
When Italians are talking to each other about where they're going to spend their holidays, the conventional question is always, "Are you going to the sea or the mountains?" In our gospel wanderings, we do both. Last week, we were down by the Sea of Galilee, listening to Jesus preaching from Peter's boat. Today, he's gone up the mountain, writes Matthew. But for Luke, he has just come down, after spending the whole night in prayer. "When day came," writes Luke, "he summoned his disciples and picked out 12 of them. He called them apostles." The distinction between disciple and apostle isn't always made by the evangelists, nor is the specific moment of choice of the 12 the same in their different accounts. But both Luke and Mark write that the appointment of the 12 took place in the hills. Mark writes,
"He now went up into the hills and summoned those he wanted, so they came to him and he appointed 12. They were to be his companions and to be sent out to preach with power to cast out devils."
A clear and simple exposition of what Jesus intended his apostles to be and do. As for what happened on the occasion Luke recounts in today's gospel, we might imagine that Jesus has retired into the hills at night to pray, and that as he comes down in the early morning, he's joined by his closest disciples. Whether this was the moment when he made his final choice doesn't particularly matter, though curiously enough in the Roman Missal version, based on the Jerusalem Bible, the Gospel begins, "Jesus came down with the 12." What does seem to be important is the mountain, writes Jesuit Father Peter Rieger.
The mountain is mentioned since it is a parallel to the original mountain of Mount Sinai, where the first law was given to the chosen people who remained at the foot of the mountain. Christ is here represented as the new Moses who gives the perfect law of the gospel.
Matthew's account stresses this parallel by separating the crowds from Jesus and the 12 he has chosen. He writes, in fact,
"Seeing the crowds, he went up the hill. There he sat down and was joined by his disciples. Then he began to speak. This is what he taught them."
And he begins the Beatitudes. So, in Matthew, as Father Rieger puts it, he sits down and teaches in the custom of Hebrew rabbis.
The crowds remain on the plain while Christ, with his disciples, is at a distance from them. It seems that the discourse is directed primarily to the disciples and only incidentally to the crowds. Christ teaches the disciples so that in their turn they might be the witnesses of his good news to the people. They were the ones who were to transmit this message.
And although in Luke Christ teaches the whole crowd surrounded by his disciples, he begins by raising his eyes to his disciples. "Fixing his eyes on his disciples" runs the Jerusalem Bible version. So in the end, it's always the 12 to whom the message is primarily directed. But what of all that immense crowd gathered there on the hillside, the Mount of the Beatitudes as it's known today? A hill, writes one guide, from which Christ proclaimed his new law of the new kingdom, and from which, the same writer informs us, one can enjoy one of the most wonderful views in Galilee. The view referred to is from a specific point, the shrine, writes another.
In 1936, the Associazione Italiane built on the mountain the beautiful Shrine of the Beatitudes and a hospice next to it. Both institutions are run by the Franciscan Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. The church, designed by the architect Barlozzi, is octagonal, each of its eight walls commemorating one of the Beatitudes. The mosaic floor is decorated with symbols of the seven virtues of man referred to in the sermon. There is a magnificent view of the Sea of Galilee from the church and from the hospice.
And before we join the crowd down on the plain, let's take a look at that view.
From this place one can see successively to the left Capernaum, further on the mouth of the Jordan into the lake, to the east the Wadi Samak with Kursi.
And if Kursi puzzles us, we find an explanation in a modern guidebook.
Kursi, located on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, next to the road that leads up to the Golan Heights, is identified as the country of the Gergesenes, or Gadarenes.
And in the 5th century, a monastery was built there. For early Christian writers and pilgrims, we're told, identified this place as the site of a spectacular miracle, when Jesus sent the demons into the herd of pigs, and they all, some 2,000 of them, rushed wildly down the steep bank and were drowned in the sea. That day on the mount, when Jesus preached the Beatitudes, was long before that dramatic episode which was to take place on the other side of the lake. But when he looked over in that direction that day, did Jesus foresee anything extraordinary? Both Luke and Matthew recount that it happened after the storm on the lake, almost as if the elements themselves were giving a warning of the evil presence on the other side. A fanciful idea, certainly. But after all, it was Jesus who said to the disciples, "Let us cross over to the other side of the lake." They didn't ask why, and he didn't say. So we may only imagine. If we were to visit the Mount of the Beatitudes today, we might find this piece of information useful. We know it is on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee above Capernaum, but we're told it is approached by a special road branching from the Tiberias Rosh Pina Road. I haven't been able to identify Rosh Pina, but Tiberias was the magnificent town founded by Herod to minister to his summer palace on the hill, as one writer puts it. In our Lord's time, of course, there would have been no special road leading to the mountain, which today is crowned by its shrine. There would have been a road along by the lake, though, from Capernaum to Tiberias, some 10 miles to the south, if only because of its hot baths. The spring of hot mineral water nearby was mentioned by Pliny, and in the time of Jesus attracted sick people from all over the country, which gave one writer cause to reflect.
One cannot help marvelling at the number of sick people who were brought to the lakeside to be cured by Jesus. At times they came to him not singly, but in great companies. One imagines that the presence of the most famous spa in the country and the gathering there of many hundreds of invalids must have been responsible for many of the crowds who sought our Lord's help in Capernaum.
It's an interesting thought. Certainly that day in June, when Jesus came down the hill and stopped at a level stretch, there were not only many of his disciples, but with them a large crowd of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. And if we read on, Luke writes that these people had come to hear him and to be cured of their diseases. And so there they all are on that grassy slope, some sitting, some standing, probably some disabled or crippled, propped up on litters or leaning on able friends, all straining to listen to what the prophet had to say, hoping for words of comfort, encouragement, and in many cases, no doubt, hoping for a miraculous cure. And Luke writes,
"Even those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and everyone in the crowd was trying to touch him, because power came out of him that cured them all.
Immediately before his account of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew writes of Jesus curing all kinds of diseases and sickness among the people.
Painful complaints of one kind or another, the possessed, epileptics, the paralyzed, were all brought to him, and he cured them.
And his fame spread throughout Syria, Matthew tells us, and large crowds followed him, coming from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and Transjordania. And so between them, Luke and Matthew have told us that the people have come from all four points of the compass. Syria is to the north, Jerusalem and Judea to the south, Tyre and Sidon to the west on the Mediterranean, the Decapolis, the 10 Greek towns, to the east, on the other side of the lake. And Father Rieger comments,
"The crowds are not only Jews, but also people from Syria and the surrounding regions, which presumably includes pagans. Thus the future universal nature of the missionary vocation of the disciples to all peoples is here implied. Through the disciples, Christ addressed himself to the whole world."
So we are all there. And though we may have to listen to the words of Jesus, not on a hill by a lake, but in a poorly heated church, with people fidgeting, children crying, distractions innumerable, perhaps we can visualize what it was like to hear those words when they were spoken for the first time. It was June, and it reminds me of lovely June days long ago, when as a student in London, there was the occasional treat of an outside lecture, sitting on the grass by the lake in Regent's Park. We had our distractions too, but so did those listeners in Galilee. They would have heard the shouts of the fishermen down by the lake and the crunching of the boats on the pebbly shore as they were pushed out into the deep. But the voice from the hill must have been nothing short of hypnotic. And when they returned to their homes, some far, far away, surely the memory of that day would have accompanied them for the rest of their lives. And for the pagans in particular, it must have been rather like the way Eliot imagines the return of the Magi to their kingdoms.
"No longer at ease here, in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods."
In the memory of those who first heard the Beatitudes, and it could be in ours, there might persist something like this.
"Always night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway, or on the pavement's grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core."
Yeats, of course. When we compare the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, there are numerous differences in the presentation of the Beatitudes. At first glance, Luke, with his four blessings and four curses, is apparently at odds with Matthew, who lists eight, even nine, blessings. But Luke is only following a literary form common in the Old Testament, such as in the Psalms, where happiness comes to the man who does good and the contrary to the one who does evil, as we heard in the first reading today.
"Happy indeed is the man who follows not the counsel of the wicked, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord. All that he does shall prosper. Not so are the wicked, not so, for they, like winnowed chaff, shall be driven away by the wind."
Scholars explain that this sharp contrast between the virtuous and the wicked is characteristic of Hebrew thought.
"It was essentially geared to the training of youth, or the art of living well, based on the experience of the older generation. The blessing or the curse is usually dependent upon some condition which must be fulfilled. When Luke says, 'Woe to you that are rich, for you have received your consolation,' the curse, of course, is dependent upon condition that the rich continue to be greedy and selfish. Implicit in the condemnation is a certain appeal to penance. So too with regard to the blessing. He will continue to be blessed as long as he continues to be meek, patient, merciful, etc."
And in both Luke and Matthew, the most powerful promise is in the Beatitude referring to persecution. As the scholars tell us, Christ is preparing the apostles for their mission to the world.
"Just as the prophets, who were the messengers of faith to the world, were persecuted because of the word, so too with the apostles and the disciples of Christ. the follower of Jesus goes to a world with different values from his, under the influence of evil. The struggle between the two is inevitable. Yet, throughout this persecution runs the theme of joy, of imitating Christ. Joy in the midst of persecution is a Christian paradox.
And it was St. Francis of Assisi, the man who was once called the only perfect Christian, who taught Brother Leo that perfect joy is only in the cross.
Happy are you when people hate you, drive you out, abuse you, denounce your name as criminal on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice when that day comes and dance for joy, for then your reward will be great in heaven.